solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Being in the company you've been in for the last 10 years, 20 years is like driving on the highway. You can race the engine 60 kilometers. You know where the restrooms are and where the restaurants are. Going to new companies like rock climbing, you're not sure where your next foot is going to sit, at least for the first 2, 3, 4 years.
Of course.
And if you go with that mindset and that you're not a racing car, if Narayan Karthikeyan has to go rock climbing, he had better change his methods.
Welcome to the 59th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman, and I work with leaders as a coach, sounding board, or as a transition advisor as they navigate their journeys. In this series, we feature conversations from leaders from different walks of life on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. My guest this time is R. Gopalakrishnan, or RG, as he is popularly known. After an illustrious career in Hindustan Lever and Tata Sons, he's had an even more illustrious career as a board member, author, corporate advisor, and a teacher. He's authored 12 books since 2007, and that's a run rate of about a book a year if you think about it. He's an executive in residence at SP Jain and a distinguished professor at IIT Kharagpur. While there's a lot of wisdom to mine from him, we try to anchor the bulk of the conversation around his book Crash, where he profiled about 15 CEO appointments that didn't quite work out. And that includes Vikram Pandit at Citigroup, Anshu Jain at Deutsche Bank, Carly Fiorina at HP, Vishal Sikka at Infosys, and more. He looks at common patterns across some of these transitions and distills them in the book. And we unpack some of that in this conversation. If this is a topic that's of interest to you, you might also like my conversation with Professor Michael Watkins of IMD, the author of the book First 90 Days, often considered as a Bible for transition acceleration. You might also find the curated playlist Settling into a New Context of Value, where leaders talk about how they adapted to a new context when they change the scenery. To know more about some of these conversations, please visit playtopotential.com. Now, without further ado, let's head over to my conversation with R. Gopalakrishnan. Gopal, thank you so much for making the time on the Play to Potential podcast. Excited to be talking to you.
Good morning. Thanks. Nice to be here.
And Gopal, in this conversation, we talk about three themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. And I'd love to get into some detail about your wisdom on some of these, specifically around the book Crash, which talks about transitions. But I'd love to talk about your journey first. Could you talk to us a little bit about your pie chart of time? What does it look like? And more importantly, why do you do what you do?
Well, you know, one way to define myself is that I'm a retired old fogey, which I am. There are multiple truths with which we live, and this is one such multiple truth. But about several years ago, when my father was alive, he said, if there's something you want to do in life, don't make the mistake that I made, which is to wait till you retire and then start to do it, because that doesn't work. You start feeling sleepy. Start doing it while you're still active in the service. Mm-hmm. That message stayed with me for a long time after he passed away. And somewhere around 2000, early 2000s, I was persuaded that I had a book in me, mm-hmm, by an enthusiastic and misguided publisher. Mm-hmm. And I started writing. And my first book, called The Case of the Bonsai Manager, mm-hmm, was published in 2007. So I've had a 13-year career writing. Part of which, I think for the first 7, 8 years, I was still in service, in executive service or corporate service. I wrote 8 books on my own, which is authored by myself, and researched, authored, written, everything. And then it struck me that we have so much experience, all of us, not just me. And if I apply the Vedantic principles, you learn from yourself. The insight is within yourself. Aham Asmi Brahman applies to management also. And I said, there are so many other people who can write, but many people feel hesitant. And I started to co-author and wondered whether the footprint of wisdom and knowledge as might exist can be expanded, which is what I've done in the last 3 years. We brought out 9 books.
Wow.
Compared to the 8 books that came in 8 years, we got 9 books in 2 years. And I like to, you said, how do you spend your time? That was your question.
Yes.
I'm trying to, you know, whatever little physical assets you have will go to the children and all that stuff. You do a certain amount of charity. But the intellectual asset that you have, experiential asset that you have, I'm trying to empty myself of it, because the more I empty, the more I get.
Very interesting.
It never seems to empty, because I get new insights out of my own experiences and the questions people ask. Like in the session I'm doing with you. This will lead, hopefully, to somebody's advantage. I don't know about how much. But I have no doubt I'm doing it for a bit of a selfish person, because it helps me to excavate. I'm like a geologist. I excavate my own rocks and find new things that I didn't know existed there.
Got it.
So I'm seeing you as an excavator who's helping me as a geologist to excavate myself.
That's a fascinating
metaphor. That's how I spend my time.
That's a fascinating metaphor. But maybe going back to the, you know, the book writing career after an illustrious corporate career, how would you describe the arc of curiosity over time? If you look back in hindsight, how has it evolved?
You know, I must start by saying why I started writing. I had no intention and still have no ambition to get the Pulitzer, for sure. But during my career, I was the chairman of Unilever Arabia about 30 years ago. And I was for the first time working in a completely different cultural environment with a completely different set of business problems, the detail of which I'm not going to go into now. And I was completely jolted out of my comfort zone, because for 25 years before that, I had been in Hindustan Lever. I had sat on every floor of the building. I knew every department. I knew everyone. And I ran into a business dilemma. And I'm not describing the business dilemma, because that will again take us away from the focus of what we want to talk about. But the dilemma was, here's a problem that I've come across. Do I rely on my analytical ability or my intuitive ability? I finally decided, because managers must get on and decide. And set me thinking. I said, what is the balance, if any? Are they opposites or are they aligned? And that's how I wrote my first book, The Case of the Bonsai Manager, in which I argued, a bit controversially I have to say, that analysis and intuition are on the same straight line. It is absolutely correct to be analytical, and you must get data as far as you can. But you come to the edge of a cliff where there's no more sense you can make with data. Artificial intelligence can't help you beyond that. Natural intelligence can. Mm-hmm. And natural intelligence will tell you whether you should jump or not. And that's when I said that top leaders lose their way in their jobs, because they continue to rely on the analytical skills they learned as young people and forget to switch on the intuition button. So that's how the journey began. And not to go into each book, because that will take a lot of time. Each book came out of some form of a question in my mind. Jigyasa, as we say in Sanskrit, you know, an inquiry. And I said, why don't I research it and write about it? And that's how I first wrote my first 8 books. Personally researching, every word is written, no ghostwriters, nothing. And then I decided to expand the footprint as I described earlier. So that's been my journey. Whole process of self-discovery. And each time I find that you thought you've discovered something, like a geologist, and I said, there's something more to dig for.
Lovely. And maybe picking on a different theme, Gopal, you know, I was talking on this podcast to a lady called Linda Grattan.
She's a professor. She's a very accomplished author, yes.
Correct. And she was a professor at London Business School when I was there. And she's written a book called 100 Year Life. And she says, given the advances in healthcare, all of us are likely to be working well into our 70s and 80s. From your vantage point, what's the advice you would give to people in their, let's say, 30s and 40s? I see a lot of people, you know, from, let's say, batchmates from IIT and IIM, who've had a very good first 15, 20 years. But as you take stock of your journey in decades, what have you learned about having a marathon of a career?
You know, I believe life is a wonderful marathon. And when you're running a marathon, I'm not a marathoner, but from what I hear from my marathon friends, when you're at the 10th kilometer, you don't worry about retiring on the 15th, unless you're my age. If you're young and fit, you. And so a marathoner keeps on running as long as he can. And I don't see a career as being any different. So, partly due to my father's influence and partly due to my own self-excavation, as it were, I realized that I will not retire. I will refire. And just the change of one alphabet, the third alphabet, from retire to refire, made a dramatic difference to the way I saw. Now, when you refire, you must know in which direction to refire, what you're going to refire with. Some people, very lovely, I have a friend of mine who went into painting at the age of 60. Somebody who went into Antim Sanskar, which is, you know, creating. He's created 14,000 places for people of different denominations to die peacefully. And so on and so forth. I decided that this is what I would do. And I refired. Now, once you've refired, it looks like an inexhaustible source of energy. Until somebody else takes that energy out of you, you can go on. So I don't see age as a constraint. At some stage, some faculty may give up, but that's not something for me to think about.
Of course. And maybe to use your geology metaphor, if I may dig for a little longer there, anything you've learned about how to think about where to, you know, the biggest question that leaders grapple with is, in which direction should I fire again? I've sort of been firing in direction X. Now I've come to this point in my life context.
That's a very good question. I have just written a paper for my own edification, not for publication. And I've consulted a number of my cohorts who are about my age group, as you can imagine. And each person has spent his time looking for what to refire about.
Correct.
But at least 5-10 years before he retired. And it was a struggle. The journey itself, you know, the joy of a victory lies in the peril of the fight. So you have to go through that process. There's no prescriptive thing. But my definition of knowing when you have arrived is when you are able to undertake an activity in which time ceases to move. Like my daily routine, I get up, I do my usual things, and then by 10 o'clock I've had my bath, my puja, and I'm sitting at my table. And this is my office. And I don't move out till 1 o'clock, somebody gives me some tea or coffee. And I have my lunch. And so I'm like working, as I have done for the last 50 years, but working on something where I don't know the passage of time. Each of us is like a little Lego piece. I love to give this quotation because we want our own shape, size, and volume and dimensions. And we spend our lives looking for a hole in the sky where we will fit in. And there are 7.5 billion holes in the sky, which is waiting for one Deepak Jayaraman, one Gopalakrishnan, one Srivastava and one Banerjee and so on. And we have to go on trying to fix it until at some stage there's a snug fit. It just slips in. That's when you realize time doesn't matter anymore. And that's the way I think I would encourage people not to get worried when they are 40 or 45. That I don't know what to do. I haven't got any enlightenment. You won't get any enlightenment. But it's by keeping on trying to fit into different shapes and sizes and finding that doesn't work. I'm not encouraging being a Rolling Stone, by the way.
Of course.
But I'm merely saying we automatically try various things. And at one stage, you'll find that this fits for me very well. And that's the when you know that that's what you want.
Got it. I love the phrase refire versus retire that Gopal uses to frame the problem. I do think once we get to our midlife, which is anywhere between mid-30s and mid-60s these days, it does get harder to figure out where to refire. I like to think of this as a parallel to business strategy. And just like companies need to think about where to play and how to win in the context of their business strategy, we all need to think about where to go and how to grow as we go through our journeys. and where to go is quite parallel to where to refire or where to play. But I think four things make it complex for us to solve. Number one, it's a multidimensional problem that involves the various domains of life. You need to think about your spouse, his or her career. You need to think about the time you want to spend at home given your life context. It needs to make sense financially. It needs to be fulfilling and purposeful. And you need to find it energizing. And that's quite a few variables to solve for. Secondly, we often operate with limited data here. The reason I say is that most of the data we receive on ourselves as we go through our work life is around how to grow. All the feedback you receive at work is often about how you can get better at the job at hand or the next role in the company, and not really what's the canvas where you could flourish. Third, where to refire is often not a sharp turn in the road, but something that's organic and has to evolve over a period of time. We all grew up making career choices in a paradigm where there are a few options lined up in front of us, often concurrently, like in the case of campus placement. Even subsequently, a lot of the career moves are driven by a call from a search consultant or a company. To put it differently, it's still a sharp turn off the road. To put it in simple terms, it's a discomfort we feel when we write a statement of purpose for a college admission, either for ourselves or for our children. Having grown up in a paradigm of cracking multiple choice, closed-ended questions, this notion of moving to an open-ended, open time frame problem can be quite challenging for us to wrestle with. And finally, if you are a successful executive, you're likely to be firing all cylinders and you're operating with limited residual mind space to thoughtfully solve where to go or where to refire. If solving where to refire is a topic of interest or curiosity, I could point you to a few resources of the podcast. One, the conversation with Herminia Ibarra, professor at London Business School and the author of the book Working Identity. She speaks about how we need to act our way into a new way of thinking, then think our way into a new way of acting. You might find the playlist Reinventing Yourself or Navigational Principles relevant, as several leaders speak about how they figured out the next mountain to climb. You might also like the conversation with Professor Jennifer Petrick-Leary of INSEAD and the author of Couples That Work, who speaks about how we need to think about these transitions as couples and not just individually. Now, let's get back to the conversation with R. Gopalakrishnan. Lovely, Gopal. I think we could talk for much longer given your years of experience as a corporate leader and as a board member. But in the interest of time, maybe diving into the book Crash that you've written a few months back. In the book, you've spoken about a few principles about getting the transition right. And I've also chronicled a few that didn't go well. And you've sort of posed a few questions around them. I used to be a recruiter at Egon Zehnder earlier for 6 years before I set up my coaching practice. So I was actually curious about maybe actually chatting with you on how the recruitment process works, even before we get into this diagnosis of why things go awry. If we could talk a little bit about how recruitment works as a board member and as an observer of transitions, apart from just the 15 that you've chronicled in your book. What have you seen about best practices in getting the decision right? When you looked at situations which have resulted in a good outcome, what about the decision process or the selection process have been worth noticing?
Well, I don't know. There is no mantra for this, obviously. Hmm. But in my track record is probably when I think back at all the a couple of hundred CEOs appointments I've been involved with, not that sure. I made the decision.
Sure.
And my track record is probably only 50-60%. Whoever's fault it may be is not material. And when I reflect back on it, I ask myself, what could we have done better? And I have certain principles, which I presume may be of interest to this particular answers to this particular question. The first is, let a group of people take the call rather than a single person. Because there is a value to collective judgment as compared to single judgment. I'm not saying everybody must sit together. Mm-hmm. It might be sequential. But sitting together helps because you discuss. Mm-hmm. Sequentially, You just get a little cryptic note on a piece of paper which the HR department assembles. It doesn't give you the picture. That's the first point. These are all, I'm going to state, some of them are absolute motherhoods. The second is, we tend to look for visible success characteristics. Track record, domain expertise, how many years of experience, answers to one or two clever questions with equally clever answers. I call those the visible. This is like trying to recruit somebody by looking at his face, his coiffure, his clothes. It's important. Go ahead, do so. But we don't step into the person's atma, may be too strong a word, but the inner part of the person. And it is that is more important. I call it the soft part, because if I get into atma and so on, I'll be stretching out of my territory. But there is a hidden part to every individual, which he is trying to suppress, he or she, and you are trying to catch. And you can do that only by simulating situations and discussing the reactions. And not being judgmental that he's right or wrong, which we tend to do because we are in a position of superiority. We have to judge whether the candidate is recruited or not. But by saying, will that work for my situation? Right? And if I may use a cricket metaphor, because this may sound rather, what I've just said may sound a bit complicated. The cricket metaphor, a batsman can go to the crease and look for the field placement. Or he can look for the gaps in the field. Now, I'm not a great cricketer, but different batsmen say different things when you ask them, how do you decide what to do and how to hit? But this is the way a recruiter should do it. He should look for the gaps in the field rather than what is in front of him. Mm-hmm. And that way you get a slightly better situation. The third and the last point I would say is discuss. Because a number of people are involved in the recruitment, but usually we leave it to some superior god in the hierarchy to decide. And we get seduced by the person's domain experience and by the person's, those are necessary conditions, but not sufficient conditions. The EQ part of it, if to use the jargon, are also necessary conditions, but not sufficient. But the IQ plus the EQ is what makes for very good recruitment. And that's what I would say is one of the things that came out in the crash book in each of the 15 cases, and I'm not saying it's the CEO's fault, that I was not in the fault business, is there was a mismatch of cultures. If you see how Chris Wiebacher was selected in Sanofi, as an example, I'm taking out of the book, and how he was fired. You can blame the board, the very French board of directors. You can blame Chris Wiebacher for being a very typical Anglo-Saxon North American. You can blame the acquisitions that he made. Those are all the visible things. But ultimately, the board of Sanofi sought a non-French-orientated international manager of competence. They found him. And when he started doing that, they fired him.
And maybe picking up on one of the things you said, Gopal, you know, often companies end up hiring leaders based on their intrinsic potential or competencies or whatever the language, right? Sort of the inner qualities and not so much on the expertise or prior industry knowledge. There I find an interesting dynamic play out, right? Often the board often has, or the recruiting, let's say the panel, the people who have visibility to that bet on something, but the organization often measures a leader on the clothes and the way the person looks. And there's often an asymmetry of insight into the leader. And it takes a while for the leader to build credibility. So back to maybe we'll get to the post, and I still want to be pre-decision. We'll get to the post-decision transition in a few minutes. But any reflection, when is it a bridge too far? How do you think about experience versus, let's say, potential, if I may sort of use those two words as black and white?
You know, when I was in Unilever, I must now relate it to my experiences live rather than theoretically. It is very rare, both in Hindustan Lever and in Unilever, to have a non-Unilever person recruited at a top level. They had such a rich and solid tradition of management trainees, direct recruits. They were all recruited by the time they were 25, 30. And then they were molded, hammered into shape as it were, right? And at the age of 45, 50, when you had to choose your new leadership, they were known devils. In Tata, it's different, my experience. For whatever the reasons may be, a lot of parallel lateral recruitments were done. I was an example of that. And so were many others. And therefore, the whole issue of cultural fitment. Now, Unilever, it was very difficult for a non-Unilever groomed person to survive. It was for the first time challenged 10 years ago when they recruited globally a CEO from outside. In fact, from Procter & Gamble and Nestle. But it all worked well. Okay, and I'm not, since I'm not privy to how it all worked, I will not talk about it. But my experience is that the people who are pushing for domain knowledge and expertise are not wrong, and you must, but it is thus far and no more.
Mm.
And what you need is the cultural fitment and the visible fitment to match. So if you take a person who's totally innocent of power sector or automotive sector and try to put him at the head of that company, like a guy who doesn't know anything about consumer products, and you just recruit him from the diesel engine industry and put him into charge of Hindustan, you're going to have a starting problem of considerable significance.
No pun intended.
Sorry?
No pun intended, I said.
but if you find a guy who's got reasonable domain experience, but not the richest, but he's got terrific leadership and human values, that's the value add. And that's what we tend to miss. We tend to say, this guy's got terrific experience in my sector. And the human part of it, the HR department to look after, that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. And maybe flipping the question, Gopal, if we take it from the incoming leader's perspective, what have you observed about what leaders do to ensure that they're able to see through the difference between romance and marriage? You know, often when you're sort of interviewing for a job as a search consultant, it's just the nature of the conversations end up being around painting the rosy picture. So as an incoming leader, what would you advise someone? What's the kind of diligence you would advise them to do before they take the plunge?
You know, as I listen to your question, I recall an experience I had, which had nothing to do with management and companies.
Sure.
I had been driving in India for about 30 years with a license and fortunately no black marks on it, driving my ambassador car in Bombay. I went to England. I was posted there for some time and I failed my driving test. And when I asked him, what did I do wrong? And I said, I feel almost offended. He said, sir, I'm not disputing that you got a license in India, but what you've learned so far is to move a car, not to drive. And then he told me five things that I did wrong and I passed the test on the second time, I think. Then I landed up now I'm entitled to drive in the United States. And I rented a car in Los Angeles Airport. I had to get to somewhere near Hollywood or somewhere for some meeting. And the guy said, well, there's the car. Just go down, start it and go. And the GPS will tell you the route. I was sweating, petrified. I was driving on the other side of the road. I didn't know how to handle the GPS system. I didn't know where I could stop. So the message I'm giving is, when you learn to drive in a company, you understand the traffic signals, the cultural mores, you don't even think about it. Like I did, after 31 years in Unilever, I knew exactly which corner had the traffic jams. Then I went into Tata. I said, they are not from Mars or Jupiter, but they had different traffic systems. They were driving on the other side of the road. They would not stop on the highway. There were some cultural mores which were different from mine, and so on and so forth. And what many, especially if you're recruited straight as a CEO, because somehow you're presented in the media, whether the company intends it or not, and whether you intend it or not, as some sort of a savior. You know, that after the prophets came, there hasn't been one for the last 1400 years, so we need another prophet. And for this company, we need a prophet. And you take that too seriously, you fall flat on your face. And I think it's very important, therefore, that even though you may be very accomplished, very experienced, you must enter the new company with a capital H of humility. rather than the capital P saying I am proven. And that's a big difference. There are dimensions to this, of course, which is the mindset with which you demonstrate what you do. If you go in with the mindset that I am proven, but I'll put on the humility act, then it reflects in your behavior. And behavior is the way you interact. So if you speak a bit imperiously, though you think you're being humble, that happens to all of us all the time. And the people are judging you neither by your mindset nor by your behavior, but by your actions, which is the outcome of the mindset and behavior. So you almost have a jigsaw where different people are different mirrors and different people are looking at different mirrors of the same person.
Got it. So just coming back to how leaders can settle in and the point you made around cultural fit, Gopal, listening intently often comes up as a key theme, right? For leaders settling into a new context.
Yeah.
If you had to double click on that, could you expand a little bit on how a leader can listen more or intently as they settle into a new context, especially for the first 3, 6, 9 months?
You know, I think the most important thing is an introspection within yourself. This is my experience, okay?
Sure.
When I was vice chairman of Hindustan Lever, the shoes would click and I would get all the salutes as I entered the building. Everybody knew me, they served me, and you know, I was the amongst the older members of the management committee, and therefore, you know, you sort of automatically feel that you're a proven guy. When I was entering Bombay House 22 years ago, no heels clicked. Nobody knew who the hell you were. And at the most, my imagination allowed me to have a few people say in hushed tones, oh, he's a new guy they brought in, you know, because some media coverage had been there, small media coverage. I was an unproven person. And every person was sizing me, as indeed I was sizing them. This is a very good situation to be in because it jolts you from your complacence of thinking you're a proven fellow, saying that I might have won Wimbledon, but I'm now in, Roland Garros. And I think it brings a certain amount of humility that I may get knocked out in the second round. So this is the most important self-introspective thinking that must come. It doesn't come automatically because for 30 years you got used to being seen as a, you know, you become a general in the army. If you now go and take charge of the Navy, one shouldn't assume that you're going to be successful. The second aspect that would come to me is to informally adopt, not appoint, adopt some mentors. Some guys who are senior people or people in your interaction zone, whom you can go and chat with and who will give you, if not a direct hint, at least a lateral hint that, you know, this is not the way we do things here. Or while your reaction was very logical, the way you expressed your reaction could be better. I found these two to be very helpful. The third is, of course, last. Don't be afraid to make a mistake. Don't make a fatal mistake, like punching your boss on the face. But you will make mistakes. And you must be willing to admit that you made a mistake. When I was a vice chairman in Hindustan Lever, in a sense, I knew what to do. I could do it. If I was a bit ham-handed, people understood. Here, I wasn't sure what to do, but I still did a few things. And when I was ham-handed, I got the signal back. Because I was looking for the signal. Nobody was coming and telling. And I think, therefore, it's like climbing. Being in the company you've been in for the last 10 years, 20 years, is like driving on the highway. You can race the engine 60 kilometers. You know where the restrooms are and where the restaurants are. Going to new companies like rock climbing, you're not sure where your next foot is going to sit, at least for the first 2, 3, 4 years.
Of course.
And if you go with that mindset and that you're not a racing car, if Narayan Karthikeyan has to go rock climbing, he had better change his methods.
It's a great metaphor. You need to feel the new surface before you start putting your weight on it. And just back to the second point, Gopal, in terms of having that informal set of people who tell you a little bit about how things work here. Any insights around where you could find them? Are they around your peer group? Is it superiors? Is there any wisdom around how we look for them?
Around your peer group is what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be subordinates as well. It could be your boss. It could be a combination. But the important thing is not that you adopted them, because it's not a conscious process. You're not sort of saying from tomorrow so-and-so is adopted as my mentor. But some people who seem to be more forthcoming, even if in tangential terms, because they want to hurt you. And it's the signals that you look for. In other words, the transmitters are all around you. But you have to tune your receiver. If you're on the wrong frequency and your receiver is not receiving, what's use of the transmitters?
Fair point. In my work with leaders who transition into a new context, I realize that suddenly it feels that the organization has become introverted. People stop speaking with you. And just like one says, if you're leading a team of introverts, you need to find a way of listening to the silent voices. Ravi Venkatesan speaks about how he adopted a few internal and external mentors as he took on a chairman role in a public sector bank.
As you know, that about 18 months ago, I took on a completely new role as the chairman of a public sector bank.
Right.
Now, I know nothing about banking, and I know even less about public sector. But yet, Raghu and Raghuram Rajan and Jayan Sinha felt that it was important that I take it on, so I did. Now, what do you do in this situation? And you know that the place is filled with landmines and you can step on anything and without realizing it and get blown up. So what you have to do is listen intently. And I did. I made it a very conscious effort to listen to a bunch of people, retired chairman of the Bank of Baroda. Okay, so help me understand from your perspective, you know, what I should do, what the issues are, how would you handle them?
Hmm.
You get a certain perspective. I went and spoke to Vagul of ICICI and PJ Nayak of Axis Bank.
Sure.
Even though they've been around and seen the evolution of the banking sector. I've met a lot of our own employees and so forth. So from this, you begin to piece together first the situation and then out of that emerges a theory of change, which is, you know, what interventions are really going to make a difference and who are going to be the important allies in this. If you don't listen and you come in with a point of view, you start, you know, jumping into action right away, you're going to make a lot of mistakes because you haven't built this nuance.
The point around developing a high resolution picture of the theory of change is an important one. Most of the transitioning leaders often have a clear sense of the what they need to do. But often the failures are because they didn't appreciate the how well enough. And I like the point Gopal makes about adopting these mentors and not necessarily appointing them. In my work with leaders, I find that leaders are a bit like an engine that is raring to go, but unless that engine builds a strong connect with the compartments, it's going to snap at some point. So if I may double-click on the point around adopting mentors, I think it's key that you invest in informal relationships internally, so that over time, you develop a cohort that you connect with that warms up to you and can act as an informal feedback loop. I've noticed that this is something organic that evolves and not a list of five names that's given to you. The key, however, is that the leader often comes into a fire and there are 50 things clamoring for his or her attention. It's key that he or she creates the mind space and the discipline to slowly build these relationships and develop a circle of mentors who can act as guardrails as they move forward. Now, let's get back to the conversation with R. Gopalakrishnan. And moving to a different topic, Gopal, in the book you talk about the CEOs being measured on two things, right? One is objective metrics, and second is fulfilling the expectations of the pecking order of stakeholders. I found that nuance quite interesting. Objective metrics, I guess we all understand. But talk to us a little bit about what you mean by the pecking order of stakeholders and maybe there are examples around how we should think about what's the pecking order in the context we are in.
So one of the things I learned, I'm not sure where I learned it, how I learned it, but I'm sure I learned it from somewhere or the other, some experience, is if you want to change things in the organization or which you're going to lead or be a leader of, first you have to change yourself. The so-called objective metrics are actually subjective. In the sense, they focus on increased profits by 20%. Diversify into X or Y, which are all fine. But those depend on the context. So we set targets for various companies in February for the year 2021. Who the hell knew COVID was coming? So the context has changed, and therefore the performance metrics automatically change. Coming to the other part, the invisible part, boards are not interested only in your achieving objectives. They are interested in how you achieve the objective also. It is stylish to say, just deliver me the results, I don't care how you do it. But in reality, we are interested in how they did it also. If a CEO is slitting a few necks every night to achieve his results, then you have to accept that there's a criminal case building up. So that's what I mean by the soft part. There are multiple stakeholders. You know, you have so far grown in your career thinking, I have one boss. If I satisfy him, everything is all right. Your board itself has a chairman, and directors have been around 20 years. Directors have been around 2 years. And then you have your leadership team, your subordinates, if I may use that word. Then you have your stakeholders, your shareholders. You have your allies, you know, suppliers, vendors, bankers. And depending on the way you act and behave, a pecking order emerges. If you're a very strong domain person, say you've been in the auto industry for 30 years, you joined an auto company, then you pick up the phone and start energizing your old network. You know, of some fellow who supplies very good components. That might be misinterpreted in your new environment. You are doing that because you are head of purchase in some other auto company. You don't sort of bring in all your old buddies. Might have been very strong in recruiting talent, and then you go and fill up the place with people from your old company, or perceived to have done so, even whether you have actually done so or not. And people don't like that. So I use the word pecking order of stakeholders to mean what was your strength until the other day can play out to be your weakness. So while you must have a 360-degree approach to all your stakeholders, without doubt, the angles of the pie keep changing depending on who's the person who's there. I have known situations where, you know, people say that, you know, he came from so-and-so place, he's filled it up with people from that place. It's not at all uncommon in CEO transitions.
Sure.
That person will say, but he's a damn good guy, and he was interviewed by 5 different people. But it's the perception that you left, that you filled it up with people from there, from a particular bank or a particular company in that field. Some CEOs have the attitude that now that I'm the CEO, I can tell everybody what to do. I am the boss. Well, nobody in the world is without a boss. Sometimes even a prime minister finds he has a boss in the form of a party chief. Every husband knows he's got a boss. You know, I mean, we're all accountable to somebody. And I think if you go in with that degree of humility, you've got a very good chance of making the transition.
Moving on, Gopal, in the book, there's a line where you say that directors seek effective solutions while CEOs look for efficient outcomes. Say more here. I was wondering if it's linked to the principal agency problem that we talk about in terms of, you know, who owns the business and who runs the business. I liked the distinction you made between effectiveness and efficiency. How does that play out in the context of a CEO coming in?
What you mentioned about the principal agent is probably one vector. You know, this is like music. It has multiple layers. And if you're a discriminating person, you can feel the layers. So yours is one such layer. I'm not disputing it. It's an obvious one. But I had something different in mind. I have tried this very often in Tata management training centers and other places where I might have given a talk in the past. I will ask the question, do you think a top leader must be more focused on effective or efficiency? And many of the people think they are the same thing. Many of the people think, what's the difference? Then a shootout happens, conversational shootout, where they say, well, at the very least, you must be efficient. If you're not efficient, where's the question of being effective? And then it sort of deteriorates into semantics between efficiency and effectiveness. So in order to get a more clear description on this, I started using a metaphor, which I've alluded to in one of my books. If I put a pot of honey and ask a bee, if I could speak to the bee, to get to the pot of honey, he goes round and round in circles before he alights on the honey. If I ask a human being, he will just get up, turn his head and walk straight. The human being is efficient. The bee is effective. Now, it's to do with the anatomy of the bee, and I don't want to get into that discussion in the interest of time. But the anatomy of the bee doesn't allow him to be efficient. And therefore, he has to go round and round in circles before he alights on the honey, which he desperately wants as much as the human being. Take a second example. Since most of us don't spend our time watching bees getting to pots of honey, how does water flow down a mountain's slope? Never in a straight line. Unless you are sitting at Niagara Falls, which is not a mountain slope anyway. It takes the contours of the mountain under gravity to find its way down. It is seeking to be effective. Efficiency demands that the water droplet falls straight down vertically, right? But it will hit obstacles and hurdles. Think of how blood flows in your veins. It's not in a straight line. It's in waves. And that's why when an ECG is taken, if you switch on the monitor, it will go, oh, 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 if you heard your own ECG. So the law of nature is that things move in spirals and circles and not in straight lines. And to me, that became a very effective way of communicating to people. There's a huge difference between effectiveness and efficiency. And then I found very interesting ramifications, because people in the group would say, you know, that's why our company goes around in circles before taking the decision. And it doesn't matter which company you're talking about. It never takes a decision in a straight line. It goes to that committee, that committee, that committee. It goes around in circles. And then finally, the capital proposal is approved or the acquisition is approved. And that metaphor I'm using to explain since I've written some book on this, I could go on and on forever. I shouldn't do that. But there's a huge difference between efficiency and effectiveness. Now, coming back to the question of the board is looking for effectiveness. Not at the expense of efficiency, but if they have to, they would rather err on the side of effectiveness than efficiency. Like COVID is going on now. Of course, I want efficiency. I want costs to be controlled. But I want effectiveness. I don't want dead bodies lying all over the factory or the head office building.
What sorts of things would you put in effectiveness when you say effectiveness, just for us to grasp the nuance here?
Effectiveness means adjusting your actions to the topography of the land in which you're operating. And efficiency means bore a tunnel through and get and do it. So that's why mountain slopes, roads go round. You could bore a hole through. I mean, it costs you probably a lot more money and it's probably more unstable. But let me give you one. You know, metaphors always help because it opens our mind. When I was young, Hindi was made compulsory. And it was a nightmare for me because I had to learn multiple languages apart from speaking one at home, multiple languages. And you know, the South erupted. Yep. That's a well-known story. Now, there was a guy called Purushottam Das Tandon, who was the MP, who was a huge Hindu chauvinist. And he was the guy who was pushing Pandit Nehru. Pandit Nehru gave us 15 years' time. That is an effective measure. It sort of, you know, the conflagration was put down. And during those 15 years, metaphorically, he called Raj Kapoor, Devanand, Dilip Kumar and said, yaar, Hindi picture chalao. And Hindi has spread over the country. Today, if you go to Tamil Nadu, no auto rickshaw driver will object if you speak in Tamil. But when I was young, If you spoke in Hindi, he would reply to you in English or not reply at all. I was very, very interested. I went to a small place called Tiruthirappundi. Most people can't even pronounce it. And they were watching Kon Banega Karodpati. And I said to him in Tamil, I said, you know, do you understand what's going on? This is Amitabh Bachchan. They said to me back in Tamil, very rolling, rolling Tamil, sir, when 1 crore is involved, how does it matter whether it's in Tamil or in Hindi? Now you see the difference between effectiveness and efficiency.
Just moving to a different theme, Gopal, you talk about the notion of a CEO having the right mental model with the board. And you say that the CEO needs to treat the directors as your senior friends. Say more here. I found that quite nuanced. What do you mean by the mental model here?
You know, a board has different kinds of people on it. Some will irritate you. And I've been a CEO and I've also been a board member. So I've seen both sides, as it were. And for many years, not for just 1 or 2 years. When I was a CEO, I said, my mindset, unexpressed of course, was, what do these founders know about my business, which I don't know? I would be respectful for somebody who was 10 years older than me or more senior to me hierarchically. I might have been dismissive about somebody who's closer to me. I didn't see them as people who could add value until later in my CEO-ship. I said, hey, you know, there are so many dimensions here, I should listen to these guys. And I started to change my method. When I first became a CEO, I took that attitude. It happens to every CEO. He sees the board as an unnecessary bunch of old uncles who are paid to do nothing in particular and get in his way. Now, if he changes that toggle switch in his head and thinks of them as friends, I use the word senior friends. I don't mean in terms of age. Some of them may be age, some of them may be in experience, some of them may be in wisdom. They may be our lawyers or accountants. It doesn't matter. And that he could go and chat with them, then he will get a different outcome. It becomes a bit like, who's a CEO's mentor? He doesn't have one. Nobody in his organization is going to tell him. And his wife can tell him. That's where the Clementine mirror comes, which I've also referred to in one of my books. But assuming he doesn't discuss his board meetings with his wife every evening, and assuming she's not greatly interested, he needs a mentor, a person who can pull him down a few pegs or push him up a few pegs. A board member may be able to do that. It's not guaranteed. But if you don't even keep the window open and keep them as your circle of friends and not say boo to them, there's a chance that one friend or the other will tell you. Think about it. And therefore, I think CEOs hopelessly fail. And I have done so myself, by the way, in my time. Not all the time, but for the first few years of becoming a CEO. In regarding their board as potential founts of another opinion. They are like the walls of a cliff. You're shouting in the cliff, in the mountainside. You need some cliffs to reflect back signals to you. If you don't use those cliffs, you're going to be lost in the mountain.
Got it. I love that metaphor again. To your point, metaphors do bring it back to life. I like the metaphor of cliffs reflecting signals back to you. However, the point to mention here is that sometimes board members are a little far removed from the situation on the ground. And in my work with transitioning leaders, I observe that if the leader is not settling in well, the organization often goes silent. And when you don't have a critical mass of relationships, it can be extremely difficult to decode silence on your own. That's why I think it's critical for leaders to think about architecting fit-for-purpose feedback loops that can keep reflecting the signals. And sometimes, it's hard to extract real data through organizational processes, given the biases and conflicting agendas. As a coach working with a leader in transition, my first step often is to build trust with some of the key stakeholders early in the journey so that I'm able to get closer to the real signal so that I can help the leader with that input. Earlier in the podcast, I'd spoken to Michael Watkins, professor at IMD and the author of First 90 Days, often considered a Bible for transition acceleration. He speaks about the criticality of fit-for-purpose feedback loops.
Just to start with the basic premise, Deepak, that, you know, In general, organizations do a poor job of providing feedback to leaders in new positions, especially when they're brought in from the outside. And why is that? Because there's a sort of sense they have to get their feet, you know, that give them a chance, you know, or a reluctance on the part of, you know, direct reports to kind of give upward feedback, or in the case of the board just may not see, you know, what's going on. And so I'm a huge believer in providing structured feedback after, you know, pick a number, 90 to 120 days, certainly not longer than that, because that provides some discipline, you know, in the sense of giving some serious structured guidance to the new leader upon which they can act before things have gotten to a point where, you know, there are very serious things going on. And so, you know, can the leader do that themselves? Absolutely. Should they? For sure. But I think it's often better done by, you know, having a coach who can go out and conduct those stakeholder interviews. And my process basically, and probably yours is the same, Deepak, is I do an initial set of stakeholder interviews. And then after 60 to 90 days, I go back and meet the same people, right? So now I've got a little bit of a relationship with them. You know, I can, it just makes it easier to kind of collect the sort of, you know, real feedback about how this person is doing.
Getting this piece right can be critical and can be the difference between a hairline crack being corrected or turning into a full bone fracture. If you find the podcast purposeful, do take a moment to rate and review on Apple Podcasts or any other platform where you consume this content. This simple act from you could make a big difference, as this helps other listeners discover this podcast, given the tsunami of content out there. Do also consider paying it forward to Antarang Foundation, a not-for-profit that I work with and support. To know more, please visit the Pay It Forward section at playtopotential.com. Now, let's get back to the conversation with R. Gopalakrishnan. Let's talk about the Clementine Mirror, since you mentioned it. I found that interesting as well. You talk about how leaders can take advantage of their spouses, who sometimes can sort of give them the harsh truth. So if I could dig a little bit more there, what's the inside there, Gopal?
You know, we say the CEO's job is very lonely and all that stuff. It's as lonely as you choose to make it. If you want to be a hermit of arrogance, then you could be so. But actually, there are lots of resources around you. And you need those resources because your brain is damaged. As I've said in my book, in Crash, power damages your brain. And to repair the damage, it's like if I hurt my shoulder playing tennis, then physiotherapy helps to restore it, if not surgery. In the same way, if I've got power, there's nothing wrong with it. If I exercise power, there's nothing wrong with it. But I must understand that it will produce some distortion in my brain and my thinking process, and I need a physiotherapy for it. This is called brainotherapy. A spouse is one such source. It's not the only source. So I've used Clementine because she happens to be the wife of Winston Churchill. It could be your wife, it could be a very trusted colleague, it could be a person whom you superseded, but who's an old friend for 30 years, it could be a board member, it could be anybody else. You have to be receptive to it. The Clementine story itself, I don't know if you want me to narrate
it. It's a good time to maybe briefly talk about it.
Well, you know, I was very struck when I go to London, when I used to go to London, I would often visit museums and so on. I went to the Imperial War Museum in the locker room down in near St. James Park, Regent's Park. And I found a letter there, framed and put up on the wall. And when I peered at it closely, it was handwritten by his wife, Winston Churchill's wife, Clementine, to him. And it read something like, "My dear darling Winnie, you're a wonderful man. The nation needs you now." It's dated 1941 or 42. But the other day I heard people saying that you are now becoming irascible and impossible, and they are not able to talk to you. My darling Winnie, you know I love you so much. I wouldn't want anything better for you or for this nation than success in the war. Why don't you mend your ways a bit? And it had all, it was a bit torn up and then put together again. And the story behind it, I learned later, was that she wrote this letter he came so tired that evening that she said, no, I can't hurt him further. She tore it up. Next morning, she said, if I don't tell him, who the hell is going to tell him? And she put a letter together. And that's what's framed and kept there. And then, of course, I've got the actual words and all, which I've mentioned and reproduced in the book. Now, this is what happens. I don't know how many times my wife has told me what a prig I was in a particular interaction. She says, I don't understand what subject you were discussing. I'm not interested in, because that's not my field. But the way you spoke to this guy was wrong. And when I reflect on it, very often, even in a marriage, the spouse tells the other person, I keep saying wife, but it could be the other way around. So I'd rather use the word spouse. It's not what you told me that I object to, but how you told me. Show me a married person who hasn't been through that discussion. So how you do things matters a lot. And this is where the Clementine mirror came in. It is not that Winston Churchill was wrong. It is not that he took the wrong decision. It is not that... but the way he came to his right decision was wrong.
Fair.
Now, Clementine mirror is optical mirror does to your face. It shows you your how many pimples you got on your face, especially if it's concave. A Clementine mirror is nothing but a concave psychological mirror.
Got it.
Who provides the mirror doesn't matter.
Understood. Earlier in the podcast, I was speaking with Tasha Urick, an organizational psychologist who's been studying the phenomenon of self-awareness for several years now. She calls self-awareness the meta-skill of the 21st century, and as part of her research, has profiled a few people whom she calls self-awareness unicorns. People that started from a not-so-great place when it came to their self-awareness, but ended up doing a lot of work on themselves over the years to really understand themselves.
And that's part of what we saw with our unicorns is there's a quote by F. Scott Fitzgerald that's something like, the definition of true intelligence is to be able to hold two opposing viewpoints in our minds and still retain the ability to function. Our unicorns were able to get feedback and say, you know, this is really different than the way I see myself, and that's okay. That doesn't mean I'm wrong and they're right or vice versa. It just means that there are different ways of seeing me, and those different ways are valid. And that's where it comes to the prism metaphor. So most people think about self-awareness as something, you know, the simple metaphor would be, I look in the mirror, I see my reflection, and that is who I am. But it's a lot more complicated. And everyone probably remembers from science class when they were young that when you shine a white light through a prism on one end, on the other end, it comes out as a beautiful rainbow. And the way I like to think about self-awareness is, you know, it's every single reflection or every single light that goes through, you get a richer, fuller picture of who you are. So every data point that you get, whether it's your own, whether it's your spouse, whether it's your coworkers, your employees, your boss, each of those are valid and helpful.
Building on what RG says, whether you see it as a concave psychological mirror or as a prism, there is a lot of data to be gathered from the loving critics around you, people that care about you and can be candid with you. In the coaching work I do, I find it really helpful to speak to the spouse and a couple of close friends of the leader who know them from childhood. At senior levels, whether I'm helping solving how to grow or where to go, it's really helpful to understand what energizes a person, when is he or she in flow, what demotivates the person, and so on. I tell people if they need to get to know me, a 30-minute chat with my wife is likely to be more insightful than 10 reference conversations on me from my past colleagues. Not tapping into the Clementine mirror is a huge missed opportunity. Now, let's get back to the conversation with R. Gopalakrishnan. And the other point you talk about in the book, Gopal, is leaders having a certain level of porosity to co-create a good outcome. I found that phrase quite interesting as well. Talk to us a little bit about what you mean by porosity, and maybe there are a couple of examples just to embellish the point.
You know, when you get into leadership position, I talk to brain damage. One of the things that it does to you is to give the feeling that you have the answers to all the questions. and answers to some things where people don't even have questions. You know, you get into that sort of mindset. And so you have decided on a particular course of action. This acquisition should happen or this capital expenditure should occur. And you are merely selling it to people. You're like a salesman who's taken a soap made in the factory and you're just determined that he should buy that soap. That's a wrong attitude. In some cases, it's fine. But in many cases, that's wrong. Because co-creation means I take and show him that I can make this type of soap, I can make that type of soap. You know, do market research in consumer business. You find out, do you want a freshness soap or do you want a beauty soap or do you want a skin softening soap? He says, oh, all these things are possible. I would rather have a bit of that and a bit of that. And you come back and co-create the soap for him. And decisions in the CEO or in the boardroom have to be often co-created. If there's a crisis, obviously I'm not asking for you to do. You still try to build the elements of co-creation. And when I use the word porosity, if he has made up his mind and he's merely selling it, very often CEOs say, I have to sell this idea to other people. Please understand, if you've reached a stage where you have to sell, if it's the odd idea, yes, I understand. But if the permanent mode of operation is that you've made the decision and you're just selling it to people, then you're going to have a bad market. That's what I meant by porosity.
Very interesting. Sort of make interactions a two-way exchange and not just a sales process, right?
Yes, you know, it's like an automaker would make a prototype or a model.
Yep.
And then the model will be shaped. He'll put it into a auto show and people will make comments. He'll increase the flares a bit. He'll bring down the hood a bit, increase the headlights. If you can't do that as a CEO, then I think you've got a problem.
In my coaching work, I find that this piece is often a derailer for a lot of type A leaders who are often outstanding in problem solving. It's like transitioning from unlocking the power of your CPU to leveraging the potential of cloud computing, and they require very different approaches. While the education system we go through helps build our CPU, it often doesn't tell us how we unlock the power of cloud computing, of all the wisdom around us. The only piece I would add to what RG says is that when you come across with the right level of porosity, not only do you get to a better answer or a solution, you also end up building better relationships with the people around you, which sets up a virtuous cycle for the future. One of my earlier guests, Jennifer Garvey Berger, speaks about the notion of listening to fix or listening to win rather than listening to learn as a potential trap, especially when we lead in a complex world.
I have us look for what certainty feels like and begin to notice that as separate from a cognitive process. Like, what does it feel like when you feel certain? You can often notice some things your body does, like I move forward in my seat. I start thinking ahead to how I'm going to defeat the disagreement or the perspectives of others. Like I have a sense of righteousness in me. Now, when I notice those things, I'm able to say, oh, wait, this is an emotion. This is closing me down to new possibilities, to new data, and I could totally be wrong here. So asking myself, what is it that I'm really believing right now? Not what's true, but what do I believe is true? And then how could I be wrong about this? Allows me to listen in a new way, not to defeat the other person, not to listen to win or listen to fix their ideas, but to listen to learn from them, to hold my mind open as a practice, as an intentional practice, as opposed to just going with this emotion that bowls over my capacity to learn.
Are we listening with adequate porosity in our minds? Is something worth thinking about as we go about our lives, more so when we are transitioning into a new context. Now, let's get back to the conversation with R. Gopalakrishnan. Moving to a different theme, Gopal, I was curious, I mean, we briefly spoke about getting a leader from a different industry based on intrinsic potential and characteristics. I want to sort of dig there a little bit more because there, the organization often is not privy to some of the hidden qualities that the hiring panel is betting on.
right? And the leader sometimes gets measured on traditional characteristics, like how much does he know my industry, how much does he know my customers, and so on and so forth. In those situations when leaders transition from context A to context B to a very different industry or space, what have you seen in getting those principles and getting those transitions right?
As I said earlier, you have to go into the capital H. Like, for example, when I joined Tata's, there's not a single industry which I was familiar with. Power generation, making trucks and motor cars, creating telephony networks. I mean, these are the boards I served on, you know. I was not familiar with these. I was a little more comfortable with things like making chemicals and pesticides because it had a similarity to a consumer goods business like Hindustan Unilever. And I remember I used to go and spend my Saturdays or whichever the holidays there like a student. And I still have my diaries of the notes I took. I would go down and sit with the front-facing people trying to learn and always walking away saying, I'll never, never in this lifetime know as much as these guys. Because they have spent the last 20 years doing this. And of course, one of the things that every leader should do is to go and talk to people less powerful than himself. It helps you to be humble. It helped me a great deal to be humble when I went to Trombay Power Station or to Pune factory of Tata Motors to find so many people who were much junior to me in the hierarchy but who knew infinitely more than I about that particular subject. And if you can go in with that attitude, the guy also recognizes. But of course, I don't expect him to know everything. He shares more willingly, just like you would share your knowledge with somebody who's interested in it. And I think in a leadership transition where you do not have that domain knowledge, this is the most important lesson that I learned. It promotes capital H, which you have to adopt after shedding capital E for ego from your last job. So it is like you played Ravana in this scene. In the next scene, you have to play Rama. You don't change your mindset. You're not going to be able to pull off both, you know?
Understood. I'm smiling because given the lockdown, our family with kids are catching up on the old Ramayana and Sagar rerun of Ramayana that we grew up watching in Doordarshan. But I hear you. It's worth understanding the key reason the organization has brought you on board. Ravi Venkatesan speaks about his transition to heading Microsoft in India after several years in Cummins.
You've got to figure out what really matters. Okay? So in Microsoft, it was clear why the company had hired me, because it was because we were becoming irrelevant in a country of a billion people. And so they wanted not a technology guy, or at least Bill and Steve wanted somebody who understood India. So within 6 months, I said, you know, in order to become relevant, this is what it takes. And here's a set of things we ought to be doing. And it was plausible. I don't think it was rocket science or brilliant. And they said, great, now go do it. Where's your team? And by the way, here's $1 billion of investment. Go make it happen. And the team in India said, wow. Holy cow, you know, this guy really has done an amazing job getting us all this investment. They used to beg for every headcount. And suddenly we had an abundance of riches.
Having the clarity around the axis of value add can be immensely clarifying when you're being brought into a new space. It gives you focus in terms of what you need to do to move the needle in terms of outcomes and winning trust in the system. Let's get back to the last piece of the conversation with RG, where he speaks about the leaders that inspire him, the books that have left a mark on him, and more. Lovely, Gopal. I think it's been a very insightful conversation. If you will, I'd like to wrap up with a few rapid-fire questions just to get top-of-mind responses to some of these questions.
Right.
Three books that have left a profound influence on you?
Ah, now you're going to be into... I think if I have to think of three books, I was very, very influenced by Discovery of India, by Nehru, because it showed me that India is a colloidal society, a wonderfully different society from any in the world. I was very influenced by a more recent book called Sapiens.
Oh, yeah.
By Yuval Noah Hariri, to show that we are all small microcosms in a long series of evolutions. Don't take yourself too seriously. And at a more practical, down-to-earth level, I read Peter Drucker, Practice of Management, the old book, must be at least 50, 70 years old. But it had a deep impact on me on the importance of management. Probably it's the combination of these three that I would say has had. Yeah, that's what I can remember.
And leaders you look up to for inspiration? Three leaders that in your mind?
You know, I think there are, each person requires two types of leaders. Inspiring leaders and instructional leaders. So I'm going to break my answer into two questions. Mm-hmm. Inspiring leaders are people you don't know, but whom you read about. Books are written, tomes are written.
Sure.
So you'll find a usual list of suspects, if I may use that uncomplimentary word. For me, they are Lincoln, Gandhi, and Mandela. But I have been far more influenced by instructional leaders, people from whom I learned practical, small little things. And I didn't learn any small practical things from Lincoln, Gandhi, and Mandela. If you ask me to give a speech, I will quote them.
Got it.
If you ask me to say, what did you do when you faced this problem? I would think of three different people. One was my father. And for many of us, that's a common feature, that we learn simple, practical things, unquotable, but highly doable.
Sure.
I had two bosses. One is called Bipin Shah. He's now 88. And Ashok Ganguly, who's now 85, who also had a very instructional influence on me at an appropriate time. So those are the three I would quote.
And if you had to distill the two, three core principles with which you've led your life that have sort of endured, I'm sure there are several, but if you had to sort of really codify two or three that are dearest to you, which have helped you in your journey.
You know, my career has been as an executive, operating executive. And so the ones that come to my mind when I hear you is, remember your life is 75% doing and 25% thinking. This is not a disrespect to intellect, but a great respect for kinetic energy rather than potential energy. Okay? So 75-25 is a very good thing. If you're spending your time the other way around, you might as well be in the planning commission or a secretary to Government of India. I'm not knocking them on the head. I'm just merely saying that that's my
perception.
The second is, always be conscious of your vulnerability as a leader, not your power. If you can show that you're vulnerable, people reach out to you. If you demonstrate that you're not vulnerable and you're a blue-eyed, square-jawed, clear-headed reincarnation of Jack Welch, then you've got a problem. And the third and the last lesson I would say is you're bound to cause unintentional hurt to other people. Admit it. Don't hesitate to say sorry. I have not practiced all these three, by the way. I should give you the impression that I am some paragon of... but it's by not practicing them that I've learned the lessons that I'm responding to.
On that note, Gopal, a real delight... talking to you on the Play to Potential podcast. Thank you so much for making the time on a Sunday morning.
Thank you very much. I wish you good luck. And now back to families, both yourself and myself.
I hope you found the conversation purposeful. Three things struck me in this conversation. First, is the notion of refire versus retire, and how we can use flow as a basis for making directional choices when we get senior. If this topic is of interest, you might like the theme Reinventing Self, relevant as we discuss leaders from different walks of life on how they thoughtfully changed direction midstream. Second is a distinction Gopal makes between speed car racing and rock climbing. It's a simple but a powerful metaphor to make the point. The muscles you need to build, the nature of feedback you seek, the signals you watch out for, and so on, are different in one versus the other. If this is of interest, you might like to tune into my conversation with Michael Watkins of IMD, who's the author of First 90 Days. You might also like the theme settling into a new context, where different leaders across backgrounds speak about how they settled into a new role. This includes insights from leaders like Vinita Bali, who's worked across 6 countries and 5 continents, conversation with Dr. Guha, where he talks about Mahatma Gandhi, who transitioned from South Africa to India to lead the freedom movement, and Suresh Narayanan, who was parachuted in to deal with the Nestle's Maggi crisis. Just go to the curated playlist section and look for the theme settling into a new context. Thirdly and finally, I really like the point Gopal makes about the Clementine mirror. I believe that we all lead one life, and gathering data only on the work front is highly suboptimal when we're trying to build a picture for a leader. I ask the people I work with, how 360 is your 360? Not tapping into the insights that your spouse has, some of your friends and mentors have on you, is really a lost opportunity. In the work I do, I make it a point to speak to some family members and friends during the coaching and transition advisory work I do. If you'd like to know more about building greater self-awareness, you might like my conversation with Tasha Urich, a researcher on the topic of self-awareness. She speaks about how internal and external self-awareness can sometimes be orthogonal and the criticality of getting both. Thank you for listening. As you know, quite a bit of work goes into researching, producing, and publishing a conversation. We also try and connect the dots across the various conversations as much as we can. Hope you find that of value. If you find the podcast purposeful, I would request 2 things for you to consider. First, do rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Given the tsunami of content out there, it will help other listeners discover this podcast and seek value from it. A small action by you could make a big difference to someone else. Second, do consider paying it forward to Antarang Foundation, a not-for-profit that I work with closely. They work with children from less privileged backgrounds and help them play to their potential by imparting life skills, giving them career guidance, and connecting them to the world of formal employment. We're all seeing what's happening around the world due to economic inequity. No easy answers, but one piece we need to solve as a society is to ensure that young adults are productively engaged in a vocation that they're passionate about. Antarang Foundation is all about making that happen. Thank you, and look forward to having you at a subsequent conversation at the podcast. For more, do check out the podcast archives, which include curated playlists, painstakingly curated by theme for easy reference and consumption, 500 plus nuggets, and close to 60 guests at playtopotential.com. To know more about my coaching and transition advisory work, please visit About the Host section at playtopotential.com. Bye now.